It's Steph Dixon, and welcome to the Live Wide Awake podcast. It is episode 50. I can't believe that we've been going for that long. So I have a very special episode for you today because I got to speak with one of the most recognized and followed rock climbers in the world, Alex Honnold. You may have seen the wild documentary about him called Free Solo. And I spoke to him alongside Dr. Bruce Means, a biologist specializing in herpetology and a National Geographic explorer. So this was a very special conversation about a new National Geographic documentary airing on Disney Plus that is called Explore the Last Tipui. The film follows a world-class climbing team on a grueling mission deep in the Amazon jungle as they attempt a first ascent to climb a 1,000-foot sheer cliff. Their goal is to deliver legendary biologist and National Geographic explorer Bruce Mean to the top of this massive island in the sky known as a Tipui. Now, the team must first trek miles in the treacherous jungle terrain to help Dr. Means complete his life work searching this cliff wall for undiscovered animal species. So that's a little bit about the documentary, and we're going to be chatting to, as I said, Alex and Bruce today. So a little bit of background on both of them. Alex Honnold is a professional rock climber whose audacious free solo ascents of America's biggest cliffs have made him one of the most recognized and followed climbers in the world. Alex is also known for his ability to control his fear while scaling these cliffs of dizzying heights without a rope to protect him if he falls. And his humble attitude to such extreme risk has earned him a nickname, which is Alex No Big Deal Honnold. Alex has been profiled in places like 60 Minutes, the New York Times. He's been on the cover of National Geographic, starred in numerous adventurous films, including the Emmy-nominated Alone on the Wall, and the film featuring him free solo took home the Oscar for the Best Featured Documentary. Alex also gives away a third of his income to solar projects that increase energy around the world, which led him to start the environmental nonprofit, the Honnold Foundation. And our second guest today is Dr. Bruce Means, a biologist specializing in herpetology and a National Geographic explorer. During his 50-year research career of studying reptiles and amphibians, he has published 235 scientific articles, been involved in numerous documentaries with Nat Geo, BBC, and has discovered 14 new species, two families, and multiple subfamilies and taxons. His passion is to prove that the hidden worlds of South America's tipuis are treasure troves of biodiversity that are worth saving. Dr. Bruce is also the executive director of Coastal Plains Institute and Land Conservatory, a nonprofit organization founded in 1984 that is dedicated to conserving the rich biodiversity and elevating public awareness and appreciation of the vast coastal plains of southeastern United States. It's time to live wide awake. So for those who haven't seen the film yet, I'd love for you to walk through what was the mission and how did it really come about?
Mark Sinnott, a climber, and I have been in Guyana several times doing other climbs, sort of in this general area. And we had been trying to plan another Tipui adventure and trying to get National Geographic interested in this fabulous region. Our original idea was to do a Tipui in Venezuela and try as we might. We couldn't get the proper permits, but we were able to arrange this expedition in Guyana. And we were so excited to get Alex to come along because, you see, I'm not a robust young 25, 35 year old man. And we needed some real expertise on the cliff to join with Mark and help me do the science that we proposed. This is part of scientific work I've been doing for a long time. And it's called The Last Tipui, I suppose, because it's kind of my swan song, maybe the last expedition of this sort I'll ever be able to make. Although don't count that out, me out.
Yeah, I love that. So maybe you can explain what is so special about the Tipui and how you really discovered this biodiversity hotspot in the beginning.
Well, Tipui is an Amerindian word for mesa, you know, high flat top mountain. And there are about 100 of them in this particular part of the world. It's in Northeast Venezuela, adjacent to Guyana and Brazil. So Mount Roraima is the most famous one that may have stimulated Arthur Conan Doyle to write his novel, The Lost World. And Roraima figures in this expedition because it was always on the right side but it's been claimed before. However, Wayasapu had not. Wayasapu is a sister Tapui next to it, and that's where Alex and Mark and a Venezuelan named Foucault or Federico Pisani did the climb. And it enabled me to finish my life's work in this particular drainage system, trying to understand the amphibian and reptile life that lives there.
Yeah, absolutely. And the documentary was such a thrilling experience to watch, just the treacherous lands that you were walking in. And I was just so curious when I was watching it, because it's probably a very obvious question, but was trekking through the terrain the only really way to get there?
Yeah, basically. And I was actually on the expedition. I was reading a book called Energy and Civilization that had to do with as the name implies, sort of energy system with humanity. And it struck me that as we were trekking through the jungle, it's probably one of the few places on Earth that are strictly human powered at this point, where fossil fuels don't really help you navigate the landscape, because, you know, you can fly a helicopter to the summits of some of the Tapuis when the weather allows, but that still doesn't allow you to get into the cloud forest, which is where a lot of the biodiversity, where a lot of the animals that we're looking for live. And so, you know, and otherwise using aircraft doesn't really help you, because there's nowhere to land because the jungle is so thick. And so you really do have to trek in by foot. And it was just an interesting thing to consider that even in this sort of modern world, there are places on Earth that you can only get there by walking for many, many days. I mean, we walked for 10 days to get to the base of the wall.
Yeah. I mean, it just got more and more intense. And then watching you, Alex, like hanging from the wall like a sloth, hundreds of feet up, I was so nervous and sweaty just watching. And I was just so also thinking, like, how actually tall was that wall that you were climbing?
The wall was roughly 1,000 feet high, maybe, though the particular route that we climbed was maybe 700 feet or so. And then we struck this large ledge system that sort of traversed around to the summit. And we chose to take that the remaining distance because it gave us more opportunity to look for new species of frogs and basically look for creatures, because it was pretty vegetated, so it'd make for good habitat. But yeah, overall, the climb was, you know, big, but not crazy. You know, and we were using equipment, we're using, you know, rope safety equipment. Everything about it was as safe as it can be. But I mean, the real adventure was just being somewhere totally unknown and the big trek through the jungle to get there.
Absolutely. And you're renowned for your uncanny ability to be able to control your fear. And you even have a nickname, Alex, No Big Deal. So I thought this was really cute. But also, I was so curious about how you actually developed this ability to really control your fear. And if there ever were times over all the years you've been climbing that you were actually scared. And if so, you know, what really got you through those situations? And how do you maintain that huge control of fear that may arise?
Yeah, it's not that big of a control. I mean, it's kind of just like anybody else developing expertise in a subject. I have a lot of experience climbing now, and I've had a lot of scary experiences climbing, and so I've gotten better at managing, you know, fear while I'm climbing. But it's not like any particular gift or anything. It's just that I've spent 25 years climbing full time, and so I've got better at it over time. But I mean, Bruce and I were just talking about this, that really it's all just what you practice. That Bruce felt incredibly comfortable with all the creepy, crawly creatures of the jungle, you know, snakes and spiders and things like that. And I have no knowledge and no experience with those kinds of things. And so, you know, I don't really feel comfortable with that, but it's all what you learn.
Yeah, it's true. You know, what you practice, it definitely will be able for you to deal with things that other people can't. So Bruce, I'd love to hear a little bit more about where your passion developed, or your infectious passion for biology really came from, and kind of what that life of discovery has been like for the last 50 years of you exploring.
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot. I'm unhappy to tell you that I was born as a little boy in downtown Los Angeles, California, during World War II, and my father was away during all that time. My mother and grandmother kept me between a house and a garage with a sandy dirt little strip that I hated. And I used to find ways to climb out of it when I became a toddler. There was a pond that somebody had, a little concrete pond with goldfish in it. So I'd go over there, and that was my only way to escape the wood and the sand and go see these animals in the pond. When my dad came back from World War II, he moved us out to the wild and wonderful chaparral community of the Calabasas Highlands in the Santa Monica Mountains, where I was free to roam all I wanted to. And I loved all the plants and the animals and the spiders and the things called a potato bug and So I learned to like nature from the very beginning of my childhood. We then migrated to Alaska. I was raised in Alaska, graduated from high school there. It was a very different experience, but it was an out-of-doorsy one because we sort of homesteaded there and built a big log home. And I learned to love out-of-doors and wilderness by that second example. So I came to Florida to go to college. And the place I landed was up here in the Panhandle, which is one of the United States' top three biodiversity hotspots. So I've spent my whole career, early career, getting all my scientific acumen developed here, studying the biology of this part of the world. And what led me to South America was any good ecologist needs to have some tropical background. And I wound up through a series of happenings, happening to pass through this country that had this remote area full of tapuis, fell in love with them. And I started in 1985, going back on my own personal expeditions 33 different times to do studies there. And so it's become a second part of my life. Anyway, so sorry about the long story, but every aspect of nature is wonderful. The more you appreciate nature, the more you learn about things, the more you love it, the more you understand it. And that leads to a consideration for trying to conserve it. You know, if you appreciate something, you'll want to save it or do something to help it. And that's why I think environmental education, like what we're doing right now, and what this documentary is all about in the magazine article, is to bring to people some of the experiences that Alex and I love and have and get to do all the time, to share that excitement with readers so we can all try to, you know, be more appreciative of the planet and do our best to conserve what we can of it. Because we're not doing a very good job of it right now.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I think it's incredible that you've dedicated your life to this and you found your passion and you'll be able to share that experience through such a beautiful medium of video and now audio and all different types of ways to do it. But maybe for both of you, what do you think it would be your call out to people? So, you know, Bruce, you've sort of spent your entire career and life engaging people to protect biodiversity. So if there's like one key message that you would share to people, what would that be? And then Alex, we'll hear from you.
Yeah, it would be simply try to familiarize yourself more with nature. And that can be in your backyard. That could be downtown. You know, every living thing on this planet is connected to us. In other words, we, if you believe in evolutionary biology, which I do, of course, we have a common ancestor with every living life form on this planet, maybe way, way, way back in deep time. So we've all arrived here through the same processes. And by learning more about our fellow creatures, it makes us more cognizant of our own special place in nature, how fortunate we are to be here. And hopefully that will inspire more people to be more considerate about the environment.
And Alex, what about you?
Well, I mean, I agree with Bruce that a big part of it is just appreciating nature, spending time outdoors, you know, having meaningful experiences in nature so that you actually care about it. But then beyond that, I mean, if you're looking for things that an individual can do to try to help protect nature, I mean, the obvious things that come to mind are vote for the environment, you know, perhaps change your diet, perhaps change your bank, things like that. I mean, think about, you know, lifestyle decisions, like what your money does in the world. Think about your level of consumption, travel, things. You know, I mean, basically, there are a lot of things an individual can look at. But realistically, I mean, these are global issues that are, they're sort of beyond the scope of any individual. So, you know, I think that voting and sort of collective action are probably your best opportunity to help affect change.
There is an elephant in this room. You do know what it is. May I be allowed to quickly say something about it?
Of course.
The elephant
is human population, and it's a very political thing. I don't ever propose that government ever try to cause us to regulate numbers, but human beings ought to realize that we are producing too many people on this planet. If we can voluntarily agree to have 0 to 2 people as offspring, it certainly would help things, allow to share wealth better on the planet and bring our demand for goods and services and environment and air and precious water down. That's the elephant.
Can I sort of politely disagree? Because, you know, I think all over the world, you see that as levels of material wealth increase, population growth decreases down to exactly what you're saying. I mean, basically, like, rich countries don't have that many kids. And so, you know, population growth isn't really basically population isn't even that big of an issue. It's consumption, you know, because it's like the developed world has a much bigger impact and much higher carbon emissions, even though they have fewer children. You know, I mean, like the countries on Earth that are having the most kids are also the countries that have the fewest carbon emissions and overall generate the least amount of waste. You know, so it's like, it's not totally fair to say that it's a population problem. It's more like a human impact problem.
Very good points, Alex. I agree with you. Well spoken.
Yeah, I get all into this kind of stuff. I mean, because that's the thing is everybody's like, oh, well, what should you do? And it's like, I actually kind of think that when you start looking at things like that, we're like, oh, well, there are just too many people. And like, in a way, that's a bit of an abdication. It's like it's giving up the personal responsibility of like, well, you can still minimize your own consumption. You can still look at, you know, sort of the global 1%. I mean, everybody on this Zoom call is part of like the global 1%, basically having like the biggest impact on Earth. You know, it's like blaming population growth is sort of like, it's like the wrong direction, because it's like, those aren't the people having the biggest impact.
Well, it's no doubt complicated. Yeah. Population growth is a bit of a problem, but due to the circumstances that Alec was talking about. So what do you do? You know, how do you attack the whole big problem of the quality of the environment on the planet is declining, and if you don't follow global climate change and the carbon dioxide loading in the atmosphere and other pollutional aspects, you're burying your head in the sand. Whatever we can do to ameliorate all of those impacts is definitely worth considering, and I hope people do more and more of it. And Alex is correct. All those things that he mentioned are things we can do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think the collective good is a really big part of that, and how we can each play a role, but really it's the impact that we have when everyone does a little bit more. And so, Alex, I would love for you to share a little bit about your nonprofit as well, and kind of the work you're doing there and why that's such a vital part of this shift that we need to see.
You know, the Hanf Foundation supports solar projects around the world. Basically just anything to reduce environmental impacts and help, you know, human populations in different ways. And, you know, I mean, I think the transition to renewable energy, the transition to cleaner energy systems is an important part of what humanity has to undergo to minimize our impact on the environment. But it is just one tiny piece of the picture, because, you know, we have to reduce deforestation or practice afforestation, you know, sort of rewilding. I mean, there are a lot of things that we can do with protecting and conserving the natural world. I think that the work that I'm trying to support through my foundation, you know, I think it is important. I mean, you know, we do have to transition to carbon-free modes of energy, you know, and we do have to think about energy equality and sort of helping communities that have historically not had access to energy. It's like, that's important. But so is, you know, protecting biological diversity and protecting truly wild places like where we were in the Tepuys. And so, you know, I think that those can all play an important part in you know, protecting the environment more broadly.
And so for people listening, how, open question to both of you, but how do you think we can actually protect more? Because I think there are some people that don't actually even know how they can play a role in that.
I personally think that one of the ways is just to focus on the thing that you're most passionate about and work on that, because there's so many different things that can and should be happening in the world, like, you know, transitioning to clean energy, protecting forests, protecting clean water, you know, reducing plastic pollution, you know, I'm transitioning to different forms of transit. Like, there's so much that can be done. I think there's something to be said for individuals following the thing that they are very passionate about and working on that.
That's definitely a nice, larger view. Alex has been thinking about this a lot, I can tell you. I tend to bury myself in the minutiae of the animals and plants I study. And of course, I've unfortunately in my career, a number of different organisms I've studied have disappeared. There are some salamanders in the southeastern U.S. that I did my master's and doctoral work on, that for reasons I haven't any clue of, just disappeared throughout their entire range. They're probably related to some pathogens that we've introduced into nature. And I get probably pretty upset by the pollution and the other kinds of immediate impacts that people are responsible for. We have water supplies here in this North Florida area and elsewhere in the United States that we're terribly utilizing, overutilizing, and also contaminating. So you need a bigger look. Alex has got a great idea about doing what you can for every single thing that you can do on your own. Recycling is a big one. My wife gets on me when I don't put the appropriate waste in the recycling, and she's right. And so it's a matter of all of us learning to do our part in any way we can.
Absolutely. So final question for you both. How do you think we can live wide awake?
Well, in my case, not die. At 81, I wake up every morning and look in the obituary column. I'm not there and I feel really good. But I assume you mean wide awake by being conscious of what science is telling us about different things that we could do to make life on this planet a better, and the planet a better place in which for us to all to live.
And what about you, Alex? What do you think?
One way to sort of live wide awake would just be to remember our own rather small and insignificant place in the natural world. And I think that, you know, through things like this expedition to Lhastapuy just reminds you just how small we are in the vastness of nature, and how many other forms of life there are, and how intricate the connections between those forms of life are. And we're just one other form of life on this very large and complex world. And so I think that by appreciating the biological diversity on Earth, it kind of helps remind us that we're just one very small player. Well, sadly, now we're a very, very large player because we have such an outsized impact on the Earth. But amongst all the many different species on Earth, we are just one other species. So I think that that's a good place to start, is with a little bit of humility, where it's like, yes, we're having the biggest impact on Earth, but we are just one of many different life forms all sharing this rather incredible place.
Absolutely.
It's pretty clear that we probably can't live on this planet below a certain level of reduction of the biodiversity on the planet. In other words, how many species will support the planet and be good for us. We know from biosphere experiments where we've tried to create self-sustaining environments where people could live and be sustained that have not worked. So the problem is, at what level can we tolerate the impacts we're doing to species as well as to the environment before it negatively, really seriously impacts on us? Well, I guess the answer is global warming or global climate change. Keep your eye on that, because it's here already and it's going to get worse.
Absolutely. We're playing an almost dangerous game of Russian roulette with the future of humanity. Well, thank you both so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And for, just hearing a little bit more insight, and everyone should definitely go and watch The Lhastapuy and see more about your adventures and everything you've done. Thank you, guys.
Well, thank you.
Great pleasure being with you.
Three things I'm taking away from this conversation with Bruce and Alex. Firstly, what you practice, you get good at, and fear is kept at bay. Secondly, familiarize yourself with nature, appreciate it, and have meaningful experiences with it. And thirdly, in the fight against climate change and sustainability, focus on what you're passionate about, and remember that collective action moves the needle. I'm curious, what did you think about the episode, and what were your main takeaways? Is there a topic you want me to dive deeper into? I'd love to hear from you. You can find me at Steph L. Dixon or at Live Wide Awake. If you got something out of the podcast and you want to continue this journey with us, consider subscribing and supporting. I hope that today's conversation stirred something deep within you, ready to awaken. And until next time, live wide awake.